Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation. Recorded live during the May 2017 Youth Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
So, what I want to do today is tell you stories. How many of you like stories?
Me!
Good, I love stories. One of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is learning stories about the individuals who helped create America. I've been recently studying the Revolutionary War period, and so the stories that you're going to hear today will have a lot to do with the Revolutionary War. But let's establish a foundation first. Declaration of Independence was signed in order to give us our freedom. The Revolutionary War was fought in order to make it stick. So you can declare independence all you want, but you got to make the darn thing stick once you've declared it. And so that's what the Revolutionary War was all about. But understand that the Declaration of Independence gave us independence as a nation. It said we are going to be our own nation. It did not specify what kind of government that nation was going to have. That's what the Constitution did. So they all tie together beautifully, and they're all part of the same process. One to declare freedom, one to ensure that we actually get that freedom, and then one to tell us what that freedom means, what we're going to do with it. The Declaration of Independence is the foundation for the Constitution of the United States. But all, for both of them, the Revolutionary War was a critical part of that process. So what I want to do today is tell you stories about the Revolutionary War. And the title of this presentation, as I sent the notes in a couple of months ago, is America's Heroes, Sailing Ships, Natives, and British Redcoats. I'm going to talk to you today about generals. And this is why I'm going to. A couple of months ago, I was asked to be the keynote speaker at the annual banquet for the Sons of the American Revolution. And I was asked to speak on the topic of George Washington. Now, there is no founding father that I love to speak about more than George Washington. He ties my heart in bows. George Washington was such a profound individual, and he had such integrity. He was a good man to the core. He had the opportunity to seize power at the end of the Revolutionary War and hold it and become a tyrant. He walked away from that. And that is a profound thing to say, because most people want to grasp power and then hang on to it. Washington had the chance to do that. He said no. He walked away. He went back to Mount Vernon. Then when he was the president of the United States, he had the opportunity to implement the Constitution that he had presided over the creation of. He is an amazing man. So we're going to talk a little bit about George Washington, but we're going to talk about some of the other generals that are involved in that. So as I prepared this presentation for the Sons of the American Revolution, I was in the process of reading about the battles of the Revolutionary War. I have a great big thick book, and it is literally this thick. It's called The Battles of the American Revolution. It's by Henry Carrington. It was a book that was written 150 years ago. I have a reprint of it. Oh, I wish I had the original. Wouldn't that be fun? And so I had been studying the battles, the actual, okay, he gave orders to him, who gave, you know, and this is what happened, and the soldiers didn't follow what they were, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Been reading all of that with the battles, and as I read the principles involved in leadership and in being a general, and the principles involved in personal integrity and the courage just came to me in waves off the pages. And I fell in love with the things that I was reading. And so I've been since then reading lots of personal journals of individuals who actually experienced the Revolutionary War when I can find them. If I can't find their journals, I find biographies of them that were written as long ago as possible. I'm in the middle right now of reading the biography of General Israel Putnam. It was written in 1858, but he was one of General Washington's primary generals. And all of these books that I read all flesh out details and information about generals and about leadership and about courage and about sacrifice. And so it's my pleasure and opportunity to be able to talk to you about this today. But before we start talking about generals, I want to hark you back to another general that does not fit into the Revolutionary War period of time. And that is General Moroni from the Book of Mormon. Because as I studied, as I did this study involved in, first of all, writing my first book, which was Promises of the Constitution. When I began writing this book, I don't ever do anything halfway. I jump in. And so I wrote the book in 9 months, but I wrote 12 to 14 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. I didn't write on Sunday. And half of every day I spend in the Missionary Training Center. We live in Provo, Utah. I spend at the Missionary Training Center working with missionaries. So if it wasn't the Sabbath and I wasn't working with the missionaries, I was at my computer writing. And I made a promise to my Heavenly Father at the time I started that I would not neglect my scripture study. And so every morning before I would begin writing, I would spend a half an hour in the Book of Mormon. I was reading the marvelous description of Captain Moroni. You are familiar with it. It's in Alma chapter, right around 58-60, where it gives the description of Captain Moroni when it says, if all men are and ever were, would be like unto Captain Moroni, it would shake the very powers of hell. So I had read that in my scriptures that morning and then turned immediately to my writing, and I just happened to be writing about General Washington at the time. And I was delving into the writings of the men who served under him who were describing him. And I found myself reading almost the exact, not the exact same words, but the same concepts. And so I have come to believe, as I have studied, and I've studied, I've spent a lot of time with this, that our General Washington is the equivalent for our society of Captain Moroni in the Book of Mormon. I equate those two. And I encourage you to do the same. I encourage you to study the life of General Washington. And I encourage you also to study Captain Moroni in the Book of Mormon. Make that a matter of prayer and ask Heavenly Father to show you these two men and how they equate. But each of them presided over a circumstance that is very similar. Washington took his troops into Valley Forge, where they starved and froze because they didn't have sufficient supplies. And he kept writing letters constantly to Congress asking for more supplies. Captain Moroni had the exact same experience. He with one of the winters with his men, where he was pleading for supplies, writing letters to Pahoran and asking Pahoran for help. Neither one of them knowing that the reason their letters were not being responded to was because their Congress or the leader of the nation at that time had to flee from the enemy. Strong parallels there. It's wonderful. Okay, so let's talk about General Washington. What does it take to be a general? Okay. It takes, there's a skill set that helps you to be a really good general. So tying that to General Washington, he had served in the French and Indian War, had been a general in the French and Indian War. No, he hadn't been a general. He'd been a lower officer. He actually retired as a major. But that's where he got his experience. So as a general, you know, you have to have had a certain amount of experience. You have to be prepared for this. And so he had fought and had some successes and had some stunning failures in the French and Indian War, but that had prepared him to be a general. But he had some personality characteristics that made him stunning in helping us actually win the Revolutionary War. And one of those was that he never gave up. He had tenacity. The man never gave up. He just simply, he was like a bulldog. One of his generals, Nathanael Greene, that we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes, Nathanael Greene described the Revolutionary War from the perspective of the Americans in one sentence. He said, "We fight, we lose, we pick ourselves up, and we fight again." And that was General Washington. Where other generals would have considered battles that they lost to be defeats, Washington simply refused to give up. So that was a great help to him. He also could learn from his experiences. So when things would happen, he would ask why, he would go back, he would assess what he had done, he would figure a better way to do that. And he had the ability to take counsel from other people. Those all helped him to be a good general because he was leading David into a battle with Goliath. So understand what you've got going on in the Revolutionary War. You had these 13 little colonies. 13 little colonies. They weren't even united. A couple of years earlier than that, they had begun to become united, but basically they were 13 colonies. And he is leading them against the world's great superpower. This is literally David with his stone in his sling, walking out to face, what was he, 8-foot-tall Goliath of the Philistine army? And so the likelihood that the American colonials were going to win this war, if you had been placing bets on this, if you had been one of the people taking bets in Las Vegas on this, you would have said there was no way these people were going to win. And yet there were some strengths there and some weaknesses that didn't weren't apparent from the surface. For instance, the Americans were fighting a moral war, and the British were fighting an immoral war, because the British had been trying to take away the freedoms of the Americans, take away their inalienable rights, and they had been doing some really dirty stuff. They had been being subversive, they had been mean, they had been destructive in a lot of the things that they had done. So they were not operating from the moral base. The Americans were operating from a moral base because they were defending their inalienable rights. They had charters with the British government that gave them specific rights, and the British were violating those charters. So the Americans were not only fighting for this independence that allowed them to be themselves, they were fighting for the legal structure that had been promised to them and that was being denied. The British were trying to use the American colonies as a money thing to pay for their debts that they were accumulating, fighting all over the world. And they wanted the Americans to pay for that. And the Americans were saying, no, we're not responsible for those wars. We're not going to pay for that. So there was a moral aspect there. But in addition to that, there's a characteristic that we developed in America as we founded this nation. It's a characteristic of strength, of individual effort, of integrity of the individual, and that was missing among the British. The British nation had become, debauchery is the best word that I can think of to describe it. They had become a debauched people. Their morals had really been slipping. They just didn't have integrity as a culture anymore, whereas the Americans did. So the Americans were coming on from a position of strength and the British were not. And then, of course, there were others. The Americans could get their supplies without shipping them across an ocean. The British, and they could get their soldiers without shipping them across the ocean, and the British couldn't, and so you have a lot of things going on there. But it wasn't quite as clear-cut a situation as it looked like it was going to be. So Washington was asked to be the general of the Revolutionary War. He had competition. There were other generals that were considered. It was Congress that gave Washington that appointment. Most of the troops to fight the Revolutionary War and the immediate action of the Revolutionary War was taking place in the North, but they were calling for soldiers from the North and the South both, and they were fighting for the North and the South both. And so Congress wanted a Southern general to lead the Northern troops to tie the two together. You see, if you had all Northern soldiers, mostly Northern soldiers, and then you had a Northern leader, it was going to look like a Northern war, and the Southerners would just kind of back out of the whole deal. And so they needed someone from the South, so they gave that opportunity to George Washington. He hadn't been involved in the military for 15 years since the French and Indian War had ended. He put that behind him, and he'd gone on to become a gentleman farmer at his beautiful estate of Mount Vernon. But so when he accepted the appointment from Congress, he said to them, I beg you, gentlemen, to understand that I do not believe that I am capable of the great task that has been given to me. I beg you to remember that at the end, the resolution of this conflict, I beg that you will remember that I said that at the beginning, because he was uncertain about his abilities to do that. So he was appointed in June of 1775. And he took command of the armies in July of 1775, July the 3rd. At the time he took command of the armies, he was assuming command of an unorganized army in an undeclared war for a nation that did not yet exist. Look at the task given to him. Because the United States of America hadn't happened yet. The Revolutionary War had begun. That war began on April the 19th of 1775, but the Declaration of Independence wasn't signed until 15 months later on July the 4th of 1776. That's why you have the unorganized army for the undeclared war in a nation that did not yet exist. So Washington takes command of the army, and the battles have already begun. So they've had Lexington and Concord. They've had the Battle of Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill was the first organized and deliberate attempt to have a battle. They didn't have a commanding officer. The British had occupied the city of Boston and were creating all kinds of havoc there. They were quartered in the homes of the families, and it was a very oppressive situation for the people of Boston. And so the American colonials nested themselves on top of Breed's Hill. Now, you've heard about the Battle of Bunker Hill? It didn't exist, because it happened on Breed's Hill. We call it the Battle of Bunker Hill, but it happened on Breed's Hill. So you can figure out why that. Nobody knows why they called it the Battle of Bunker Hill. But Breed's Hill was a hill 53 yards high. Bunker Hill actually was about twice that height and stood behind it. So the American colonials had grouped themselves on top of Breed's Hill, and they dug in entrenchments. From that position, they could see what was happening down in the streets of the city of Boston. So they could see the British gathering against them. But they'd built the entrenchments. They had declared themselves ready and willing to fight. They were up there with their guns in the entrenchments. They're waiting for the British to come. And they could see the British coming toward them. The British marched up that hill, and the Americans were ready for them. The Americans opened a volley, and there were 500 men in those entrenchments up on the top of Breed's Hill. And they were all good marksmen. They waited until the British were close to them. They fired their guns in unison, and just about 500 British soldiers dropped. That was withering fire. By the way, there were 3,000 to 4,000 British troops coming against them up that hill with the 500 men up on the top. So the men fell back in disarray. Those odds are terrible. 500 men drop on one push up the hill. They dropped back, they reformed, they came up the hill again, and almost 500 of them dropped again. At this point in time, you have lost 1,000 British troops from the 500 men on top of the hill. Had the British stopped right there, the Americans would have won the Battle of Bunker Hill. But here was the problem. The American soldiers only had 2 bullets apiece. They didn't want the British to know that. In the reading that I'm doing right now, I have uncovered a reference to the fact that the British were given information that the Americans did not have any more bullets, and that's why they made the third charge. That's one of those little details that you find when you start doing historical research. So had the British stopped then, the Americans would have won that battle. But the British regrouped and came up that hill again, and when they did, there were no bullets to stop them. So the British came with bayonets. They came up that hill and into the entrenchments, and most of the 500 Americans on that hill died. They were defending their freedom. Will you look at the sacrifice that these men made? I want to tell you about one of the men that was in those trenches. His name was Dr. Warren, and he was the president of the Continental Congress, the Congress that was meeting at the time to govern the affairs of the Revolutionary War and to take the nation to the point when it could create its own system of government. He was the president of that Congress. When the word spread through the city of Boston that they were certain that a battle was coming, Dr. Warren had gone to Breed's Hill and had offered his services as a common soldier. Now, we're talking about kind of namely the number one guy in the colonies right now. But he had offered his services, and when the officers who were in command on Breed's Hill realized that, they said, "General Warren, you're too valuable to be lost here. We can't risk your life." And they asked him to not stay, and he said, "No, I want to fight. I want to fight with the people." So they offered him the command of the armies. He refused it. He chose to be a common soldier in the trenches. So when the British poured over and into the trenches, some of the soldiers were able to run and escape. Many of them were killed as they ran. Many of them were killed on the spot. Some ran. Many of those were killed as they ran. Dr. Warren was the last man to leave the trenches. And as he began to run to safety, he took a bullet in the head and he dropped dead instantly. So we had lost the president of the Continental Congress in his desire to fight for freedom for his country. But there's another little part of that story that is just poignant and tears at your heart. That battle was in such disarray that it was the next morning by the next morning, they were trying to account for who had died, who had lived, what was happening. Their reinforcements had been sent, but they arrived too late, and all kinds of things were happening, and no one had yet perceived that Dr. Warren had been among the casualties for that battle. His body was found by Dr. Jeffries, one of his intimate friends, one of his dear friends and associates, who was a British surgeon fighting for the enemy. Dr. Jeffries had gone onto the battlefield the next morning to see if there were anyone alive, anyone of either army that he could help. And he had found the body of Dr. Warren. And that is how the colonists then became aware of the fact that the president of their Congress had been killed in that battle. I want you to think, as I tell you these stories, about the sacrifice that was made by individuals. As I have studied the war situation, I have read so many battles, and I've read about the deaths of so many people, so many profound and wonderful individuals, individuals with strong moral character, individuals with lots of training, with dedication, individuals with families at home, with wives and children, with lands that needed to be managed. They were willing to sacrifice themselves to bring America into being, and it's really hard for me when I see protesters, and on our modern TV, I see protesters in the streets, and I see young people from colleges saying how horrible the United States of America is and how we have no integrity, and they say terrible things about our founding fathers, and it really hurts me. It hurts clear to the core of me, because I'm reading the stories of these individuals and I'm reading the sacrifices that they made. And I want to tell you that the people who sacrificed their lives and those who sacrificed but survived those battles were individuals of great power and integrity, and we need to love those individuals and have respect for them. So Washington had generals that helped him. I want to tell you just quickly about three of them. And then he had a couple that didn't help him, and I'm going to tell you really briefly about those. One of his key generals was Nathanael Greene. I mentioned Greene to you a minute ago in that brief statement about how the Americans conducted war. Nathanael Greene was a sawmill operator in Coventry, Rhode Island. And in 1774, the year before the before the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the word was kind of, the feeling was kind of wafting through the colonies of what was coming. And so people began, all over the 13 colonies, began organizing, drilling, and training with military skills. And Nathanael Greene was one of those. He loved to read books, and he loved to read books about warfare. And so he knew a lot about war, but it was all from the printed page. And so he began gathering together with the soldiers there in Coventry, with the young men in Coventry, and they prepared for the war. And so when the Battle of Lexington and Concord happened, they were ready. And so were a lot of other people in the colonies. We ended up with like 15,000 individuals that came to fight in the army for American freedom in Boston, in the Boston area, when Lexington and Concord happened. And the contingent from Rhode Island came with it, with Nathanael Greene at the head of this movement. Now, he had entered his training as a private. He was made colonel in order to preside over the regiment that came from Rhode Island to George Washington in Boston. When he got to Boston and the Boston area and he met George Washington, it was one of those instant bonding things. Have you ever had that experience with somebody? You meet somebody and you just go, yeah, my personality and your personality would just kind of go together. Well, that happened to George Washington and Nathanael Greene. And they became the best of friends immediately. So Washington recognized in Nathanael Greene a great gift. Nathanael Greene turned out to be a military genius. Washington had a gift for spotting talent in young officers. So he promoted Nathanael Greene to general. So Nathanael Greene went from private to general, and the top confidant of General Washington in 1 year. That's a military record for you. So Greene presided over many of the important battles of the Revolutionary War, was very instrumental in bringing about many of their victories. He learned his lessons the hard way. At one point in time after the battle for Long Island, it was Nathanael Greene that made the decision that the Americans could continue to defend two of the forts in the New York area, even after the colonials had lost that battle. And so he convinced Washington to leave those two forts standing. The British overwhelmed one of the forts and killed 3,000 American soldiers. And Nathanael Greene had to bear the pain of that for the rest of his life. Had he made a different decision, those men would not have died. He believed the fort could be defended. It could not. So he made his mistakes. He learned the hard way. All of us learn the hard way. All of us make mistakes. All of us need to learn to forgive ourselves for our mistakes. That was Nathanael Greene. Let me tell you about Henry Knox. He's one of my absolutely favorite characters about the Revolutionary War. Henry Knox was a Boston bookseller. He was 25 years old. He was about as round as he was tall. He loved good food. He and his wife were society leaders in Boston. But he loved also to read about armaments. His favorite thing was cannon. And so he would get books into his bookstore, and he would read all the books on cannon. His friends said he had a love of booming cannon that matched his booming voice. So when the Revolutionary War, when Lexington and Concord happened, Henry Knox offered his services to George Washington, along with his expertise on cannons and armament. And so Washington made him his general of armaments for the entire Revolutionary Army. During the entire Revolutionary War period. So they still have the British, and we're back still in the early stages of the Revolutionary War. They still have the British camped in the city of Boston. They need to get rid of them. They need to get them out of the city. Boston was the heart of the revolutionary movement. New York City was the economic center, but and it figures in prominently to the war, but Boston was the heart and soul. And you've got to get the British out of your heart and soul, you know. You've got to cleanse here. And so in order to get the British out of the city of Boston, they had to have cannon. Because back in the Revolutionary War era, it was cannon that you used to make a real impact in a battle. The cannon were designated by the size of the balls they shot. They had 3-pounders, 6-pounders. If you were on one of the great big huge sailing vessels, they had 21-pound balls they shot out of cannon. But as you went into battle, you usually took 3, 6, 12-pounders. Well, the Americans had no cannon, and you couldn't fight without them, and they didn't have any money to buy cannon. But Henry Knox knew where he could find cannon. He knew that in the abandoned Fort Ticonderoga, right up on the Canadian border between Canada and the United States, left over from the French and Indian War, he knew that there were cannons sitting at Fort Ticonderoga, and he offered to George Washington that he would go get those cannon. So Washington gave him the men to do it, and Henry Knox set off. Okay, that's a great story, right? Well, now let me tell you what you had to go through to get those cannon. So it's a pretty easy march to go from Boston to Fort Ticonderoga to get the cannon. They got there, they picked out 58 pieces of cannon. Some of them were small, but three of them weighed 1,000 pounds each, and one of them weighed 5,000 pounds. So consider what it is they have to get back to Boston. So now to get them back to Boston, they had to sail across Lake George. We are talking November-December time frame. Lake George was very, very cold. It is also a huge lake. If you've seen Lake George, it is a huge lake. They built boats, and they had to row those cannon across that lake on those boats. It took 8 days of intense effort of his men to row those cannon across the lake. One of the boats sank. They retrieved the cannon. I'm looking for information that tells me how they retrieved those cannon. I don't know that yet. Then once they got across the lake, they had advance parties going ahead of them to build sleds, to put the cannon on the sleds and pull them across the snow to Albany, New York. Yes?
Do you know which cannon sank?
Do I know what?
Do you know which cannon sank?
That one was one of the smaller cannon. But I'm telling you a story coming up in a minute about one of the larger ones. So they had to pull them in sleds across the snow. The only problem was they were in the middle of a winter thaw, and there was no snow. It was mud. They couldn't pull anything anywhere. So they had to sit for 10 days and wait. The snow finally came in the form of a 6-foot blizzard. They had their snow. They pulled the cannon across till they got them to Albany, New York, and now they had to go across the Hudson River. The Hudson River was frozen solid. So everything was looking great. You just take your little sleds and you pull them right across the river. Except the river, the ice cracked, and one of the largest cannon, one of the 1,000 pounders, sank. They retrieved the cannon. I can't imagine who had the strength to go down underneath the water, that freezing water, and put the rope on that cannon to pull it out. So now they've finally gotten them across the river, all of them across the river. They have only one obstacle in their path, and that is the Berkshire Mountains, a range of mountains so high that Henry Knox said when he stood at the top of those hills, he felt he could survey every country in the world. That's how tall the Berkshire Mountains were. So it wasn't such a big deal to get them up to the top, because on the back side of the mountain that they were coming from, it was a nice gentle slope. The other side of the mountain, straight down, rocky cliffs. The teamsters that were pulling the cannon got up to the top and said, "I'm not going to do this. There's no way that we can do this." And so they initially refused. But of course, they were prevailed upon, and they eventually got the cannon down, all of the cannon. All 58 cannon were pulled the last 20 miles into the city of Boston, where word had spread ahead of them this amazing accomplishment of Henry Knox, and the streets were lined with men, women, and children waving flags and yelling hoorah, and they brought the cannon to the city of Boston, and those cannon were used throughout the Revolutionary War, and they were one of the main things that helped the United States of America to come into being by winning that war. Now let me tell you about one other general, and his name is Israel Putnam, and I'm in the middle right now of reading his history, and it is just fascinating. Putnam was a very unusual individual. He had the perfect combination of characteristics to be a really good general. He had fought in the French and Indian War, gotten lots of experience. Then he had gone to Cuba to fight with the British for a couple of years between the French and Indian War and the Revolutionary War. So he'd had a lot of military experience. But he had characteristics that really fitted him well for this experience. He had courage to the point that he was just reckless, almost reckless. He would do things that other people would have to think two or three times about and maybe back out on, but not Israel Putnam. He would get the idea that something needed to be done, and he would go do it. But the other characteristic that he had was that he could be cautious when necessary. So that caution kept him from falling off the edge of the earth with his ability to take risks. But the ability to take risks prevented him from being one of those people that hung back in a cowardly way when courage was really needed. I'll give you one example just to tell you a little bit about Israel Putnam, but this is before the war. So this is actually before the French and Indian War. Israel Putnam was very well known through the northern part of the colonies. He was a farmer, but he also had sheep. And so did most of the people living around him. He was from Connecticut. And so there was a she-wolf that kept attacking their flocks. And she had been caught in a trap at one point in time and had sacrificed her toes to be able to get out of that trap. And so when she would leave her paw print in the snow, you always knew that it was her because she was missing three toes. And so for years, this wolf kept attacking their sheep, and she was decimating the flock. She was wily, she was smart, and nobody could catch her. And so Israel Putnam finally decided, I've had it with this, we've got to get this she-wolf. And so he organizes all the men in his community into groups of two, and they take turns, and they go out to different parts of the county, and they're all looking for the she-wolf so they can find out where she lives. Well, on one particular night, one of the pairs found her lair. They were able to track her back to her lair. And so they sent a runner to bring all the rest of everybody. And so all the community, all these men who were tracking the she-wolf all show up along with a lot of the teenage boys. Don't you know they were really excited to see what was going to happen with this? And so it's this big, they've got their torches and they've got their guns and everybody's going to get that wolf. And so, but she was in her lair. See, she was in this narrow opening cave way back in the back of the cave. So they thought, okay, we'll smoke her out. So they piled a bunch of brush, lit fire. She didn't come out. They tried it again. She didn't come out. They sent the dogs in. The dogs came back with their faces shredded. They weren't about to try this again. So Putnam says, okay, we got to get, somebody's got to go in the cave. Nobody's going to go in that cave. And so Putnam says, okay, I'm going to do it then. So he takes some stout tree branches and he lights them so they're torches, and he climbs in the cave. And as he related it later, you went in for about 6 feet on level ground, and then there was about 6 feet that went up really steeply, and then there was about 12 feet that leveled off. And when you got to the end of the cave, and as he got close, with his torches lit, no weapon, torches lit, he can see the wolf. She's backed up against the very back of the cave. He's now identified where she is. He had tied a rope on his leg, and the men who were waiting outside the cave had been instructed, when I wiggle my leg, pull me out from the rope. That's how he's going to get out of the cave. So he wiggles his leg, and the only thing that the men outside can think is, oh my gosh, the wolf's attacked him. So instead of pulling him out slowly, they yank him out as fast as they can. He comes out of the cave with his shirt pulled clear off of his head and his whole stomach lacerated from the sharp rocks that he's been pulled across. And he says, okay, now I know where the wolf is. So now he takes the gun, goes in, no light this time, because you can't fire a gun and hold a torch at the same time, right? So he goes in across the 6 feet, up the steep 6 feet, and starting across the 12 feet, and he can see eyeballs. And so he fired that gun, and he didn't know what happened. But nothing happened. Nothing jumped at him. So he wiggled the leg. They pulled him out a little slower this time, and he told everybody what had happened, and he says, now I've got to go back in there, and I've got to find out whether the wolf is dead. So he goes back in this time with the torch again, and he finds the wolf is dead, pulls the wolf out, and his reputation spread through the entire northern part of the United States because he was such a hero. Now, this is the man that went into the Revolutionary War as one of Washington's top generals. He was the one that George Washington put in charge of trying to maintain the city of New York and the New York area after the Battle of Long Island, when the American colonials had lost and the troops were having to be evacuated. The very last ones to come out were the ones that Israel Putnam was in charge of in the city of New York, and by the time they could get those men out, they had ships along the river pounding them with cannon, and they had soldiers on the other side ready to kill them, and Putnam had to figure out how to get his men between those two, and he did it. He got his men out. They lost almost no one. Everybody in the army thought that that entire regiment, that entire contingent would be sacrificed. They were not. They survived because Israel Putnam was such an amazing man. Now, there were a couple of other generals. Charles Lee was the number two in command in the entire Revolutionary War. He was allowed, through his own ineptitude, he allowed himself to be captured by the British. He was retained by them for a period of time. It later came out that during the period of time that he was captured by the British, he had offered to betray the Americans, to show the British how they could defeat the American army. Another one was Horatio Gates. He was one of the generals that could have been in Washington's place. He presided over the Southern campaign, and when he lost the Battle of Camden in an act of pure cowardice, he got on his horse, turned around and ran on his horse, rode 150 miles to get away from that battle and abandoned his men. Both of those men had actions taken against them, and they were drummed out of the military because of their actions. So these were the things that General Washington was dealing with. I want to conclude by telling you about one more individual. His name was Mordecai Gist. Because what I'm trying to give you is a feel for how the common individuals, not just the generals, but I want you to see also how just ordinary individuals rose to greatness because of the decisions they made. And the reason I'm telling you that is because I want you to make those same decisions. When you're in the clutch, when you have to do something difficult, I want you to be able to think of the stories of these individuals and rise to that same greatness. Mordecai Gist came from Maryland. And probably the number one source that Washington turned to when he had a pinch in the battle was to the Maryland regiments, and a lot of the reason for that was Mordecai Gist. He was a well-to-do tradesman. He began organizing just like Nathaniel Green did in Rhode Island. Mordecai Gist began organizing in Maryland. He gathered together a group of his friends. They formed what came to be known as Washington's Immortals. And when Washington had a tough place, he sent the Maryland Regiment. At the Battle of Long Island, the Americans had lost the war, the battle. They were being trapped by the British. Many of the forces were in an area where they were going to be annihilated. But if they could just create an opening in the lines, in the British lines, and hold it for just even 20, even 30 minutes, the Americans would be able to, those that were trapped would be able to pour through that hole in the lines and they would be able to escape. Washington needed somebody to send to do that. And so he sent Mordecai Gist and the men of the what's called the Maryland 400 or Washington or the Immortals. Those men, these were Mordecai Gist and his best friends, the men that he had recruited, the men that he had trained with, that they had come to this battle. They were sent to one of the courthouses, and surrounding that courthouse, they believed they could attack the sentries that were there and create that hole so the rest of the troops could pour through. What they didn't know was that stationed at that courthouse were 2,000 British soldiers. The hole still had to be created, or they were going to lose a lot of American lives. So Mordecai Gist took his men into that battle area, and for 20 minutes they kept the line open, but they gave their lives to do it. Out of the men that went into that situation, the 400 men, close to 300 of them died. They sacrificed their lives in order to create an opening in that line so that thousands, hundreds, a thousand, I don't remember exactly how many soldiers, could pour through and could be free. And when they finally had created that hole and the soldiers had poured through, it was their turn to go through, but the only way that was left was for them to go through a creek. That creek was shoulder high. They walked through the creek holding their rifles above their heads while the British soldiers sat on the banks picking them off like fish. These were the individuals who gave their lives in the Revolutionary War. These are the individuals that are your heritage, your national heritage. Even if they are not your blood heritage, they are your national heritage. I want to encourage you to find integrity in your own life and the courage that these individuals do when you're in a tight spot. But I want you also to make me a promise. I want you to study the Constitution of the United States. These men were fighting for a country that could give us a form of government called the Constitution of the United States of America that ensured us our individual freedoms. So I want you to promise me that you'll study the Constitution and that you will study the individuals who gave us the Constitution of the United States. If you were willing to do that, I want you to raise your hand. Thank you. That's a commitment. Thank you for letting me be here.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.